And now, the hosts of your 2014 Golden Globes, Kyone and Kalina Wolf.
Thank you very much. Wow, looking at some of the outfits here tonight, it's like a scene from an episode in the life of an iron picker, am I right? You know, the 2013 movie from Bosnia and Herzegovina? No?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was shortlisted for the Best Foreign Film Oscar.
Nothing?
No.
I don't think they saw it.
Okay, I see. Well, there are a lot of scores to settle here tonight. There are more open emotional wounds than Ali Mustafa's character in the film The Past.
You guys, it's Iranian.
Yeah, you know, the same director who did A Separation.
You guys should totally watch it. It's really good.
You know, Kyone, possibly we relied too heavily on obscure movies for this opening bit.
Okay, Kalina, let's go mainstream. Is Bob Redford here tonight?
In All Is Lost, he plays a 77-year-old man who keeps waking up with wet pants.
Or, in other words, the Woody Allen story.
Okay, we've learned an important comedy lesson here. Meanwhile, today on The Scramble, Gene Demby from Code Switch tells two stories of racism, critic Roger Catlin recaps those Golden Globes, and an assessment of Ariel Sharon. And now, the guy who runs the backstage breathalyzer at the Golden Globes, Colin McEnroe.
Thank you. It was a long night, actually, and I probably shouldn't have let, Jacqueline Bisset or Cate Blanchett out on stage. But people tend to second-guess me after these award ceremonies when I've been running the breathalyzer. A little bit later in the show, actually, the Ariel Sharon segment, this is how sort of on deadline we are. We decided to bump that and do something else. We'll tell you about that later on. We are going to begin with Gene Demby. He is the lead blogger for NPR's Code Switch team. This is a blog about race, culture, identity. If you're not bookmarking it, maybe people don't bookmark things anymore. I don't know. If you're not doing whatever it is that people do to make sure they actually read things that are really interesting, if you're not doing that with Code Switch, you are missing out. So one of the things we do on The Scramble on Mondays is we bring in a guest that somebody that we find very interesting, and then we ask that person what is on that person's mind. What is that person thinking about right now? And so that's what we did with Gene Demby, and he's got two topics for us. And I guess what we're going to do, Gene, is start out with the story of the man who coined the term or who's used the first recorded utterance of the term racism, and then kind of the question of whether or not he himself could be judged a racist. His name is Richard Henry Pratt. Tell us more about him, Gene Demby.
So the Pratt story bumps up against another story we did last week at Code Switch. We're kind of fascinated with the intersection of language and history, right? So Pratt was this guy. He was a former Civil War soldier who would have been considered a progressive in his day. He wanted to save the Native American people who were dying in the plains from disease and from starvation. And so he's the first person ever recorded saying the word racism. We don't know that he coined it, but he's the first person who recorded saying it in the Oxford English Dictionary. That's in 1902. And he's railing against the evils of racism. And so Pratt, he eventually persuades the government to let him send up a boarding school for Native Americans. But what Pratt wants to do, and this is the other thing he's famous for saying, is kill the Indian, save the man. Pratt wanted to basically beat out, sometimes literally beat out, Native American culture from the kids at his boarding school. He wanted them to be assimilated into the white world. And so his boarding school became enormously influential. There ended up being dozens, if not hundreds of them around the country. And they became mandatory. The government mandated that the Native people have to send their children to these schools. The end result, though, is that 100 years hence, every native language in the United States is either extinct or endangered. And that bumped up against another story we wrote last week, which was by my colleague Kat Chow, on a woman named Emily Johnson Dickerson. She was the last Chickasaw speaker, the last monolingual Chickasaw Indian speaker in the United States. There were thousands of Chickasaw speakers in the 60s and 70s. Now there are only 65, and they're bilingual, and they're aging. So she was the only person left in the world who only spoke that language. She was 93, and she died at the end of last year.
You know, looking at Richard Henry Pratt, he's a very complicated character, and that legacy is very complicated because, you know, it is striking how much of his imagery about this assimilation goal of his is kind of violent in nature. There's another segment where he talks about how he wants to immerse the Native American in white culture and sometimes, like, holding their head under the water of white culture for really long periods of time. I mean, it sounds like waterboarding or something. It's a violent description. On the other hand, you sort of look around at the other policies at that moment directed at Native Americans and at Native American culture. And it's sort of it looks kind of like the best of a group of evils, right? I mean, there almost wasn't another set of policies that was anything other than forced relocations or confinement to reservations. And another bit of the complexity of all this, Gene, as brought out in the Code Switch post that you did, is that a lot of Native Americans at the time wanted to go to the schools. Once again, they might have been the lesser of a bunch of evils, but they seemed like the most attractive option on that basis.
That's right. I mean, some of those schools were a lot of the chiefs, the tribal leaders, who were some of the people who were initially targeted to send their kids to these schools, because they figured if they get the chiefs to send their kids, they could get the rest of the tribal members to send their kids as well. What happened was they just looked at the calculus, like, hey, these kids are here on the reservation and they're starving and they're cold, and tuberculosis was rampant. At least there, at least, you know, hundreds of miles away from the plains, at these boarding schools, there would be food, there would be shelter. And Pratt was, you know, for his time, he was progressive. You know, he kind of traded in kind of biological determinism, the idea that people are natively and inherently inferior, for a kind of cultural imperialism, that there was something wrong with native cultures that needed to be eradicated in order for these people to survive.
So just back to the language question for a second, say a little bit more about why it's important. In other words, you have this kind of landmark moment, as you said, the last person who spoke monolithically, Chickasaw, did not speak English, communicated pretty much exclusively in the Chickasaw language, dies. Meanwhile, there's a small group of other people who are essentially bilingual, right? There are still people left who can speak some Chickasaw, but it's not their primary tongue. Why is this important? Why does Code Switch, why do you have that interest in these jeopardized living tongues?
Well, I mean, the big thing about languages is that there are so many ideas and concepts that are very specific to, you know, to those tongues, right? I mean, we always make the joke, and I'm sure you do sometimes too, like, there's got to be a word in German for this, right? Yeah. This is a very specific kind of experience or feeling that our language is not equipped to kind of encapsulate. And so when you lose a language, you're losing a way of looking at the world, like time and space and orientation to other people, to the divine even, you know? And so whenever one of these languages kind of slides off into oblivion, we're also losing an entire way of seeing the world and the universe.
I mean, actually, from what I learned about Chickasaw from Code Switch, Chickasaw makes German look unambitious in terms of the coining of words, right? Chickasaw, there are words that would be entire sentences in our language.
Yeah, Kat Chow, who reported out that story for us, she couldn't even do that part of the interview over the phone because it was just the word was too long. It was too hard to spell. One of the words was, I think, like 30 characters long. And so, yeah, there are words that both tell you, like, who one person is to the other person, but also, like, where they are temporally, like where they are in terms of their time placement to the thing they're referring to. I mean, it's really complicated. And those are the things you lose out. There is a Chickasaw revitalization project that is attempting to bolster the language. And apparently, having 75 or so speakers is not really bad. There are some languages that have, you know, even fewer, just 3 or 4. So, but Chickasaw is kind of approaching really, really bad shape right now.
You know, back to Pratt, who, as we say, was a progressive in his day, even though his only real vision was a Native American who resembled as much as possible a white person in terms of behavior, in terms of understanding, in terms of religion. I mean, the whole idea was to Christianize all of them. This was the solution to the quote-unquote Native American or Indian problem, was to basically just make them into carbon copies of white people insofar as was possible. So as you draw a line out from there to now, obviously things have changed changed a good deal. I mean, do you see some modern day analogs, or are we so far past that? I mean, it seems obviously, you know, there's still a pretty strong current of anti-bilingualism in some of the more conservative areas of the American political conversation. I mean, do you see this issue playing out in modern terms in significant ways?
Well, you can even move away from the issue of language and bilingualism. Tanner Colby, who's written a lot about race, wrote this great book, which you should pick up, called Some of My Best Friends Are Black, which is about the history of segregation. He looks at his high school in Alabama and why segregation failed there. But Tanner Colby wrote this really great piece in Slate just last week about Saturday Night Live. And it was about integration and assimilation, and Saturday Night Live was the peg. But the bigger idea was that one of the reasons we do such a bad job integrating our spaces in American life to this day still is that we are trying to bring people who are not necessarily culturally when we talk about integration, we're talking about people who are adept in different cultural spaces, right? And so it's not just we want brown people in these spaces. It's more like we want brown people who have the most white experiences in these spaces, right? We want the brown people with these experiences that most resemble the experiences of the people who are making the decisions. And so that's a really tricky thing that and he points out that this is how diversity advocates and people in hiring managers talk past each other, because they don't understand that they're kind of asking for different things, right? But to the issue of bilingualism more broadly, yeah, it's a thing that, you know, is obviously really contentious. Language is a really contentious thing. Language is the basic building block of culture, and so to be an American in a lot of people's eyes is still to be an English speaker. And we see the consequences of that thinking through Pratt and his teachings.
You know, back to the other point that you were making, though, it's a really fascinating one that I feel a certain kinship with, probably in a fairly flawed way, as the father of an adopted Mexican or now Mexican-American son. And you know, the struggle in bringing him up was really complicated, because in some ways you feel like the skill set you need to give them is the ability to function in the white world more or less as you just described, in a way that kind of mimics all the attributes of the people who make decisions and who have power. On the other hand, there's obviously a real, you know, need and goal to preserve what's real about his own ethnic identity. And I've totally screwed this up, and as he would be the first to tell you. But it's complicated, right? I mean, it really is, in all of the ways you just described, a question that I don't think have an exact answer for.
Right. I mean, and, you know, the name of our blog is Code Switch, right? Which is a sociolinguistic term that just means to kind of jump back and forth in a conversation, sometimes within the same conversation. You're trying to orient yourself to the people you're speaking to. So the way I'm speaking to you right now is not the way I would speak to my mom, right? I'm a black kid from South Philly, and so I talk to my mom a very specific way, right? And I talk to my friends in a very specific way, and I talk to you in a different way, or a hiring manager, or, you know, someone in a public space in a different way. And so what we might see more of is more kind of advocating for this kind of this code switching, this cultural bilingualism that we don't right now we tend to be very black or white about, like, this is the way you speak, this is a proper way of speaking, right, and this is the wrong way of speaking. Instead of thinking that way, we should be thinking of there are contexts in which people can speak these ways, and we find ways to both celebrate all of those contexts and not say that one is better than the other.
Well, we're going to shift from there, although I feel like I could draw a bright line from one topic to the other. But you really went out and got into the weeds with comic book. I mean, really into the weeds. I grew up as a comic book nerd. Unfortunately, I grew up as a comic book nerd in the 60s and 70s. So in some ways, a lot of the stuff that got talked about in this fascinating blog post on Code Switch was a little over my head. But the basic question isn't a new one, and it isn't over my head. This all started out a little bit from one artist's sort of repurposing of the incredibly successful X-Men line of comics. He basically just sort of retinctured the X-Men and showed them as African-American superheroes. But that kind of lit a fuse, right, that led to all kinds of really interesting questions. How did you get into this? Why were you so interested in this?
It came across our field. It came through our field of vision through a site called Metafilter, which is just a site where people have conversations about these things. They share links that they find interesting. And we found the work of this artist named Orion Martin. So he repainted to, as you said, repigmented the X-Men to be brown people. That started this whole conversation about representations of race in the comics. So for anyone who is not familiar with the X-Men mythos, the X-Men are superpowered people called mutants. One of the big themes of the X-Men universe is that they are discriminated against because they have superpowers, right? And because they're different from normal humans. So there's a wide constellation of aggressions and discrimination that they have to kind of navigate. It's supposed to be an allegory for all kinds of things, from the civil rights movement to the AIDS crisis. The X-Men's leader, Charles Xavier, is often held up directly as a Martin Luther King analog, and his nemesis is held up as a Malcolm X analog. And so one is kind of pressing for integration and one is pressing for kind of separatism. What's interesting about having this conversation about these themes is that most of the X-Men, most of their primary cast has been a bunch of straight white guys, right? And they're an allegory for, at different times, gay rights and civil rights and outsider status. But it's always, the people who are the focus and the locus of these conversations and who have these conversations are often blonde-eyed, blue-eyed characters, right? And this whiteness is interesting in the context of the X-Men because of its themes, but it's not just the X-Men, right? I mean, Superman is from Krypton. He's from billions of light years away, and he lands in Midwestern United States, and he can pass for a white farm boy, and that's just, the white default, right? It's like this idea that whiteness spans galaxies. This is just the way that you would look if you were an alien who landed on a planet somewhere.
Well, it's also about passing, though, and passing is something that comes up in all of these conversations. Came up a lot in your conversation with these experts about comic books, too. And Superman is about passing. I mean, a lot of people feel as though Superman, some of the scholars who've written about Superman talk about him as really a kind of playing out of the Jewish immigrant experience. I mean, in fact, it was for them almost entirely Jewish writers and artists who created Superman, and it seems very much like that's what he's doing. He's passing it. Passing comes up in a lot in the conversation, as I say, that you guys had on Code Switch. And just to sort of give people, just to clue people in, because most people don't read comic books, but everybody goes to see movies. So we do have a little tiny clip from one of the more recent X-Men movies. And let me set it up a little bit. Michael Fassbender, who perhaps not insignificantly also plays a really terrible slaveholder in 12 Years a Slave, plays the younger Magneto in this clip. He's, as Gene just said, more the Malcolm X figure, more the don't try to pass, don't try to assimilate, insist on your own separate status as important and probably superior to the others. And he's talking to a fellow mutant, a younger mutant, about the folly of putting a lot of your energy into seeking acceptance from the non-mutant world.
If you're using half your concentration to look normal, then you're only half paying attention to whatever else you're doing. Just pointing out something that could save your life. You want society to accept you, but you can't even accept yourself.
So I don't know whether they're Gene, that's it in a nutshell or not, but that's at least one of the questions that in a pretty interesting way, X-Men brings up over and over and over again, right? We're back to our previous conversation. Do you try to become as much like the people with the power and the decision-making abilities and the so-called, mainstream of life as you can, or do you opt for something different? Or is there a mutant equivalent of code switching?
Right, and there's a really good another moment in that movie. That's the X-Men First Class movie, and that movie was really great at teasing out a lot of these themes in a way the other X-Men movies were not. There's another moment in that movie in which Magneto's giving this speech to a kind of a coterie of young mutants, and he's talking about the folly of passing and trying to pass in a world that will not appreciate you. And what's really interesting is that all of the white mutants think of him as being ridiculous, and they side with Charles Xavier. But all the mutants who are either disfigured or people of color, obviously, like, it resonates with them. They, like, zoom in. Like, I mean, there's a lot of, because that movie is set in the 60s, there's a direct reference, I think, to the Civil Rights Movement, or a really on-the-news reference anyway. So everyone, all the brown people kind of say, hey, there's something to it. And it speaks to this idea that assimilation is done on the backs of the people who the hardest part of the lift is on the backs of the people who are the segregated, who are the ostracized.
It was kind of only mentioned in passing in the conversation that you orchestrated on Code Switch. But to me, one of the shocking things was that Hollywood or anybody is having trouble pulling the trigger on some of these changes. Because one of the things that, the comic universe has done is made it possible for a lot of these characters, these iconic superheroes, to exist in multiple forms with different identities. And, I mean, there's like four different possible Green Lanterns, including one of whom was African-American. And it's hard to follow if you're not immersed in it. But from the point of view of the movies, for example, it was mentioned in passing that that in a future Fantastic Four, somebody had contemplated having the Human Torch be Michael B. Jordan from Fruitvale Station. And Friday Night Lights. He's a terrific young actor. And that somebody was told, or the answer was, it's not time right now, or we're not ready to do this. And to me, if you wanted to revive the Batman franchise tomorrow, the decision you'd make is to have Idris Elba be the new Batman. I'm amazed that anybody's hesitating about this at all. It just seems like such a natural thing to do.
It does seem like a natural thing to do. And it's always really interesting to see fanboys and fangirls get really upset on these about these kind of recastings, right? I mean, who wouldn't want Michael B. Jordan in their movie at this point, right? He's like, he's going to be a big deal. He's a really great name to attach to a movie. And, you know, the Idris Elba, who you just mentioned, his name has been floated as a potential Bond, you know? Mm-hmm. But for a lot of people, I mean, fanboys and fangirls are really invested in the kind of textual accuracy of the stuff they love. And so for a lot of that stuff, they feel like these things would fundamentally alter the text. It's not clear how they fundamentally alter the text, but they feel they will. And they are often really adamant about not changing them. And when you press on it, they will, you know, jump up and down and say, hey, this is not about race. You know, this is just about being true to the character. But if it's not about race, if there's nothing inherently, you know, white about Bond or white about the Human Torch, right? Or, you know, why can't this person be a person of color?
I mean, the other home run thing that I think came up on your blog was this X-Men character, Emma Frost, being turned into Beyoncé. Once again, you know, from a sheer, you know, money-seeking box office point of view, it just seems like such an incredibly obvious thing to do.
I mean, Emma Frost and Beyoncé, once someone pointed out the parallel, I can't unsee it. Like, it's there all the time. Beyoncé is always kind of scantily clad and wearing frilly stuff, and Emma Frost is always ridiculously inappropriately dressed in the comics. I mean, she's fighting, you know, she's fighting bad guys in 4-inch heels and thigh-high knee boots. And so, I mean, you know, it is really silly. And I think, you know, I think this stuff might change as time goes on. I mean, there's a huge segment of the comic book readership that is brown, right? And that is female. They're not represented as much in comics. And I think that's changing. But I think a lot of that is because of kind of the behind-the-scenes makeup of comic book creators. And I do think that's changing. And I do think once those people get in the back rooms, they complicate the stories a lot. I mean, you know, the Kents, Superman's family, has been rewritten as hardcore militant abolitionists. The reason they went to Kansas in the first place was because they were fighting the evils of slavery. And in one of the Batman movies, right, there was a reference to the Waynes, their manor, the big manor that Batman lives in, being a stop on the Underground Railroad. So people are trying to insinuate kind of our history and our evolution on these issues of race into these stories. But, you know, time will tell as to whether they actually turned into actually a brown Superman or a brown Batman somewhere in the near future.
Did you read comic books as a kid?
Oh, gosh, I spent so much of my money on comics.
Yeah. I mean, I had that sense just from everything you just said and what's in the... Well, I mean, and so that was a little bit earlier in the process. You're younger than I am. But and it seemed to me that as comic books at that point tried to diversify, they kind of did it on that kind of one black friend model, right? You know, there was sort of just... There was one. There was always, like, you would get one here and there. It wasn't really a cultural change. At least that would have been... That was my sense as a white person watching that happen.
Oh, yeah, there were definitely tokens. There were, like, and there were the brown people always had, their power was always weirdly related to some stereotype about their race. I mean, there was Iron Fist in those guys. They were like super-powered martial artists, and they were Asian American, and there was, like, Black Lightning, who was black, and he could shoot lightning. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was very, like, underlined. And that stuff started to change, I think, a little bit in the 70s and 80s. But it used to be really, really heavy-handed. It was a kind of tokenism. And Storm, one of the X-Men, is obviously important here. She's, you know, well, been there from not the, quite the beginning, but almost the beginning. And she's a black woman, and she's one of the most popular characters. But she's always held up as this kind of diversity talisman. Like, you know, X-Men can't be, it's definitely inclusive. Look at Storm. She's been around forever. But that's kind of, she more proves the exception. I mean, she's the exception that proves the rule.
Absolutely. Jean Demme, so great to talk to you. People ought to be checking out Code Switch if they're not. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Colin.
All right. We'll be back after this. We'll be wrapping up the Golden Globes. Also, Roger Catlin will be talking to us about the TV Critics Association press tour. Okay, shifting gears a little bit, but still staying with culture, we're going to talk to Roger Catlin, a blogger, freelance writer living in Washington, D.C. You may remember him as the rock critic and the TV critic at various times for the Hartford Current. His work now appears in the Washington Post and in Salon.com, among other venues. One of the things he did last night, pursuant to his duties, is watch the Golden Globes. So, Roger Catlin, welcome back to our show.
Hey, Colin, how are you?
Good. So was there, I watched some of the Golden Globes, and well, maybe we should just begin with this award ceremony itself, which was, to my way of thinking anyway, not taken very seriously for many years, and seems to have in recent years risen in status, so that to the degree that anybody takes any award ceremony seriously, this one is not a joke anymore.
Well, it's whenever you get that many celebrities in one place, there's no denying it's coverage possibilities for our outlets today. I mean, people get excited about that stuff. People get excited about the dresses and stuff. It's the only award show that has the TV stars and the movie stars together, so that's one thing. And to see them interact with each other is kind of a fun thing to see in the tables where they're all drinking, which is all also different from the other award shows. But it has the possibility to fly off the rails from time to time, and certainly last night it did. There was a time that it wasn't on the air at all because it was taken, it was such a joke. It was after the year that Pia Zadora won,
yes,
Most Promising Star, after she and her husband flew the entire Hollywood Foreign Press Corps to their island to wine and dine them. NBC didn't have it, put it on anymore.
Yeah, was it like they had to serve a suspension for that one terrible act? Well, you know, I think the drinking is a not insignificant part of this, although it's actually pretty early in the day where they're holding it. It does appear that people do arrive on stage not in full possession of their faculties. And so I assume when you say that the show flew off the rails last night, occasionally, that's what you're talking about. Anything particularly jump out at you?
Well, early on, Jacqueline Bisset had kind of a rambling speech. I mean, I think it usually comes from people who don't expect to go up there.
Yeah, just based on where Jacqueline Bisset was sitting last night, it was clear that whoever arranged her seats didn't think she was going to win. And then she got up on stage and just kind of stared at the audience for what was the usual allotment for your thank you speech. And after standing there kind of silently for a while, started speaking roughly around the time the band was playing her off.
I think she also said afterwards that she had expected the award would be the second to the last, which I guess if you watch award shows, is never the case for her role, which is actress in a miniseries. So she was misinformed. And so it looks bad when that happens. But a lot of people are don't expect to get the awards, and I'm surprised how many of them just haven't planned anything in the back of their mind.
Was there anybody last night who it seems to me that one of the winners last night, obviously most of the winners in the film category were movies that people knew about, and maybe an exception would be Dallas Buyers Club, which won some pretty major awards last night. It's a movie that a lot of people just didn't manage to see the first time around. Maybe it's a big winner. Over on the TV side, it does seem like this new police comedy series featuring Adam Sandberg was a really big winner last night.
I don't understand. I mean, it's a nice enough show. I mean, I don't think it's as good as the other comedies on Fox. You know, New Girl and The Mindy Project, just to talk about shows that are on Fox. But, I mean, Modern Family was shut out. Girls was shut out. I think they were honored last year, but they were shut out. So it was a surprise. It's conventional, and I wouldn't say what Andy Samberg does on that show is really a stretch in acting in any way. He just kind of smirks and acts goofy in a way that he did on Saturday Night Live. I mean, it's like Adam Sandler winning an acting award. It's just kind of surprising.
Name similarities notwithstanding. If anybody wants to call in about this, if you watched the awards last night, also we're going to talk a little bit about what Roger learned at the has learned so far at the TV Critics Association press tour. Our number, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. We've got a little clip here just of, I mean, one of the more tweeted about acceptance speeches was the speech by Matthew McConaughey, which may have also involved some consumption of champagne or whatever that the drink of the night was that involved champagne, because it was a little bit more towards the end of the evening. We're just going to catch the tail end of Matthew here.
My wife, Camilla, who's not only put up with me for all this time in our 7 years and this last 3 years of wonderful work, but I mean kicked my ass out the door and said, go get it, McConaughey. Go get it, my man, my king. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Kids, Levi, Vita, Mr. Stone. Love y'all.
Raising two major questions. Does his wife really address him as my man, my king? And does he have a child named Mr. Stone?
You know, he might. It just might happen. I mean, it's kind of sad that you know, he has this kind of persona that people remember from his very first film as a stoner. But at the moment he was giving that speech, he was doing some great stuff in this new HBO series, True Detective. So,
which I watched last night, actually. I was sort of flipping around, and I decided to commit to that after a while. And it really is. It's a pretty first of all, it has two guys in it who are among the weirdest people in the world of acting, whose performances are weird and whose off-screen demeanor often matches that weirdness or has in the past, Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. I mean, the idea of pairing the two of them together, it just seemed like, you know, there'd be no relief from the weirdness of it all. But it's so far anyway, after you've probably seen more than an hour, but after an hour, I'm pretty mesmerized.
I've seen 4 hours, and they play off each other so well. And just the way the story is structured, where they're doing a case in I don't know, the early 2000s, and then they revisit it, you know, 12 years later because of some police inquiry, and they both changed considerably, especially McConaughey. So then there's a mystery of not only about the murder itself, but what the hell happened in those between years.
Well, as somebody said on Twitter last night, Matthew McConaughey really is proof of the adage never give up, because he was not taken seriously as an actor for many, many years, and suddenly over the last 3 years has had this transformation where you kind of want to see everything that he does now, whether it's Mud or Magic Mike or this True Detectives thing or the first 10 minutes of Wolf of Wall Street. Wherever you look, he's doing something kind of interesting, always a little bit on the edge of going over the top, but dialed back just enough so that it's not ridiculous.
He's kind of mesmerizing when he really tries. And someone, he was here at the TV Critics Tour last week, and someone asked him about what a great year he's having. And he didn't even see it that way, because he figured he had done this work. He had done the HBO series a year ago. It doesn't come to him like that, you know. These are things he did over the last several years, and they're all kind of coming together, coming out at the same time. So it looks like he's suddenly decided to really try.
The speaking of the TV Critics Tour, so one of the other series that started last night was Girls, and it seems as though these TV Critics things there are plenty of opportunities for very strange moments. You have people like Sarah Palin debuting a new show on the Sports Network or some network I've never, Sports Channel, something I've never even heard of. But anyway, in the midst of all that, still it seemed as though the most talked about moment was a press conference about the series Girls, in which somebody brought up the kind of now age-old question about all the nudity engaged in by Lena Dunham. And it seemed as though the people on stage kind of turned on the questioner and just ripped into him for having asked the question at all.
It was the very first question. It was from a guy from the rap who's, you know, pretty good questioner. But he asked, you know, why is there so much nudity, particularly from you, Miss Dunham? And, you know, nudity is done in other shows in service of something else, you know, I guess, you know, before a sex scene or something. And in her case, she's sometimes playing ping pong or just kind of walking around and doesn't have any clothes on. And anyway, she had a very good answer. She just said, well, it's part of the human condition, you know. Mm-hmm. We are naked sometimes, and that's reflected in the show. But Judd Apatow was there as producer, and the last time Girls was here, he did a lot of the talking because he was the one people knew. Mm-hmm. But he was just kind of injecting himself as kind of a protective uncle here, and saying, the problem is the panel heard the question, why are you naked? Because you're a little overweight.
Mm-hmm.
But he never said anything like that, and he didn't imply that she didn't deserve to be naked. But then the other producer there, later in the press conference, was asked a question.
And she said she was still seething over the last
one. I wasn't even listening to you because I'm in a hate spiral over that first question. So it's like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That's a more serious condition than just asking innocently about nakedness.
And it does seem as though Girls, I mean, one of the things that it tries to do, I think, is knock you a little bit off your own. Either it completely mirrors the sensibility of a generation that you and I don't belong to, which is quite possible, or it kind of tries to knock you off stride a little bit. I mean, I'm not going to explain this in any detail, but in last night's first episode, there certainly was a scene not involving Lena Dunham, but involving the character Jessa that caught me, and I would assume most people by surprise, involved her behavior with another patient or inmate or whatever you would say at a rehab center. And it was... It was pretty graphic and it was pretty suggestive. But I think some of the purpose of the series is to sort of hit you with something that you're not expecting at that visceral, fleshly area that it so prefers.
Yeah, I think it's stuff that's happening. And I think the season, I've seen about four of those too, and each episode gets better and better too. And I think they're doing some really great things. And I think a lot of people look at it like a sociology experiment, like, oh, what are these 20-year-old girls up to? What are they thinking of? But I think it's written like a comedy. I think everything that's said is really funny.
And
a lot of people don't take it that way.
I would agree. And I thought the first couple of episodes sharing last night were very funny. Of stuff that you saw and of things that you encountered on this press tour, does anything either give you great hope for the coming television season or great despair?
Well, True Detective certainly did, and that's already started. There's another one with Chloe Sevigny that's on the A&E network for some reason called Those Who Kill, which unfortunately is another serial killer drama, but it's based on a Danish series.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is set in Pittsburgh. I really liked it. I think there's some mixed feelings about it among the critics here, but that and True Detective really stood out to me. There was a press conference just before this phone conversation about the new 24. They're coming back with 24 in May on Fox. So Kiefer Sutherland was here, and the producers were talking a little bit about what that's going to be about, one of which is it's going to be 12 hours and not 24 hours.
Well, he's getting older. I mean, maybe part of one of the subplots will be his Medicare eligibility.
Get that form in here now, Chloe.
I mean, I think another thing that some people will be watching, we're going to have to wrap up pretty soon, we're talking to Roger Catlin, but one of the things a lot of people will be interested in is, you know, there's sort of a nice little arc going on involving John Oliver, who sat in for John Stewart this summer as John Stewart was off directing a movie, did a marvelous job. I think almost everybody agreed that he just did a lovely job without overreaching in his role. Then got this offer from HBO. I don't know how many people saw his last moment there on the Comedy Central show, on The Daily Show, where they did a little montage of his stuff that he clearly wasn't expecting and said goodbye to him. And he just wept. He broke down and wept in Jon Stewart's arms in a very lovely way. But I assume that they're pushing this thing at where you are right now, this new HBO Jon Oliver thing.
They had Jon Oliver here talking about it, but he couldn't say much about what the show was going to be like. He'd only started work this week. It will be a topical show. It'll be on Sunday nights. It'll start in April. I don't think it'll be exactly like The Daily Show, but I can't imagine it'll stray too far from that, at least at first. He talked a little bit about that last show, too, and how they had him working on some other project all day, thinking he was going to do this big segment on the Queen or something, and Stewart just shuts him down on the air and goes into this big tribute. And he was a little embarrassed because English people are not supposed to have any emotion whatsoever, that he wept on stage.
Yeah, no, he cried like a baby.
I think that'll be fun to see him.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think he handled that whole thing rather than having it be a sort of all about Eve kind of thing. I mean, he really handled his duties really well, and you know, in a way that made you like him, but still be very happy to get John Stewart back when the time for that came.
Yeah, I think he put his own stamp on it a little bit. He's just a little nicer, a little more interested in the guests, and a little more gushing towards the guests than Stewart is sometimes. But he did a great job.
Yeah, and hyper-prepared, too. Very prepared. One noticed that a lot about him. So, Roger, it sounds like the really, really good news for me about last night is I don't have to watch Brooklyn 9-1-1 or 9-9-9 or whatever it's called, despite all the Golden Globes that it won. I'm actually under no cultural obligation to watch this series. I'm asking you to absolve me.
It's not terrible. It's not hateful. It's amusing enough if it's on. I don't think it's appointment television by any means, though, and I think there's lots of other comedies that would rank higher on my list, at least. It's not, you know, you might want to watch to kind of see if it lives up to this kind of praise, but no, I don't think it's something that needs to be on your must list.
Yeah, no, I was hoping you would just give me total absolution on sitting
it
out.
No, I will not.
All right, Roger Catlin, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right, good to talk to you, Colin.
All right, that's Roger Catlin. When we come back, you may have heard the speculation that perhaps a crime was committed when those lanes to the George Washington Bridge were shut down. We're going to talk to attorney Daniel Clow about whether there's any traction there.
Crack, 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 smile for the cam. Crack, 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 smile for the cam. You know how the story goes, and this is how it sounds at award shows.
I watched all the audience shots at the Golden Globes and I never saw Gollum. He's such a big movie star. Where was he sitting? Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Jackie Lauper and Skylar Magnoli. The part of Bill Curry was played by Idris Elba. Greg Hill tweets for us a WNPR Colin and appeared in the intro. For links, articles, videos, and photos of the Faith Middleton Show staff trying on their X-Men costumes, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, the future of the Republican Party in Connecticut. And now, back to Colin.
All right, as promised, and once again, I want to remind you that here on Mondays, we do something called the Scramble, which means that we come in on Mondays without too much of an idea, sometimes with a small version of an idea, but without too much of an idea of what we're going to do. We wanted to be able to be flexible enough to talk about things that intrigued us from the week's news or the weekend's news or even things that appear on Mondays. And that's what happened with this next segment. Earlier today, Daniel Clow, on his blog, Appealingly Brief, put up a blog post about the whole question of whether or not an actual crime could have been committed with the famous lane closures leading to the George Washington Bridge, which caused such a media storm last night for Chris Christie. One person who thinks that perhaps a crime might have been committed, in fact, he doesn't even think perhaps a crime was committed, is the governor of Connecticut, Dan Malloy. Let's hear what he had to say.
There is no doubt that a crime has been committed. Who it's been committed by remains to be seen. I'm aware that there is a legislative inquiry as well as a federal inquiry, federal prosecutor looking at it. I'm more than happy to take the governor at his word, but obviously this has a long way to go.
All right, so Daniel Clow, an attorney in Hartford, his blog, Appealingly Brief, took up this question and cited some press coverage of it so far. So Daniel Clow, I think to a lot of us, it sounds like a dirty trick closing down these lanes and something that really inflicted quite a bit of misery on a whole lot of people. Whether or not that rises to the level of a crime is a separate question. So first of all, just in general, as you look at some of the coverage of it so far, what are you seeing?
Well, I see at this point a lot of what I'd call early stage speculation about whether a crime was committed and what statute, that's always the key for prosecutors, what statute would match the conduct that was at issue. So, you know, the U.S. attorney in New Jersey and other prosecutors are trying to figure out, well, what statutes might apply to this conduct.
And so some of these statutes would have to do with sort of basically commerce-related statutes, right? Things that sort of affect people's ability to get where they need to go to do what they need to do, right?
That's right. And that's where people are looking in the first instance. In the second instance, they'll look at whether there were any efforts to cover up the crime. There's always a lot of fun that prosecutors have with obstruction of justice charges. But if you stick with your first part, The U.S. Supreme Court has said in a number of decisions over many, many years that citizens of the United States have a right to travel, a constitutional right to travel between states, you know, interstate travel. And there is actually a federal criminal statute that makes it a crime for people to conspire to prevent individuals from exercising that constitutional right.
We're talking to Daniel Clow right now. It seems to me, first of all, another thing we know, I mean, this all puts you in a very odd position. I'm sort of asking you what things people can be charged with, which is ordinarily not your role in life. Ordinarily, your role in life is to help the government understand why they shouldn't be charging people or why, if they have charged people, a grave mistake has been made.
Right.
So, first of all, as you look at that, I mean, are you persuaded by that? Or as you look at that, you're not a prosecutor, but if you were a prosecutor, would that strike you as a legitimate avenue to go down?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It would. Now, remember, prosecutors have discretion as to whether or not to actually charge a crime, even if the conduct fits within the letter of the statute. But I think there's a growing consensus amongst people who are looking at this that the actions of the deputy chief of staff and the governor's appointee to the port of authority fit within the conspiracy definition, and that the objective of that conspiracy was to make it injure people in their ability to travel between New Jersey and New York.
You know, one thing that I haven't seen speculated about, but which I just personally, as a non-lawyer, wondered about, simply because it's something that's come up here in the great state of Connecticut in the past, is what's sometimes referred to as honest services fraud. In other words, this actually did come up in the case of Governor Rowland, right? That another thing that they can do is, if they want to charge you with something, charge you with effectively the theft of honest services as a government employee.
That's right. And that statute had been used, but it was, I don't know if I'd say gutted, but substantially restricted by a United States Supreme Court decision several years ago, which said that the prosecutors had been interpreting it and courts had been interpreting it too broadly. So it's not clear that that will be the kind of hook that could be used in this case. But New Jersey has, under state law, an official misconduct law, which is very similar to what you just described, and it criminalizes the unauthorized exercise of official functions for the purpose to obtain a benefit or deprive a person of a benefit. So there may be state New Jersey criminal laws in addition to federal criminal laws that would apply here.
I guess the other thing that makes this interesting, obviously, is that to whatever degree there's a state and federal inquiry, that means, I mean, it's one thing to get as many documents as we can under the Freedom of Information Acts. We've been through a lot of that in Connecticut. But really what can happen now, what will happen now, I assume, with subpoena power is that the federal government can get an awful lot out of information or just through the grand jury process, right?
A tremendous amount of information through the grand jury process. And it can force people to testify, although we're already seeing some people taking pleading the Fifth Amendment, and that will be an obstacle to the federal information gathering process.
All right, Dan Clow, thanks so much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Colin.
All right, Dan Clow blogs at Appealingly Brief. Let me just quickly take the last couple of minutes here, or last minute or so, to tell you a little bit more about what's coming up this week. First of all, this is the Scramble, which we do on Mondays, a kind of a deadline show. We're always interested in your feedback. Let us know whether you like the tone of the show. You can email me about that or anything else at Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. Tomorrow is a show about the state of the Republican Party here in Connecticut. There are 4 Republicans for every 7 Democrats and 8 unaffiliated voters. They always are fighting an uphill battle. But this is regarded as kind of an interesting and possibly pivotal political year for a whole bunch of different reasons. We'll bring the state chairman, Jerry Labriola, in along with a bunch of other prominent Republicans, talk to them a little bit more about what they think their chances are and how they begin speaking to a state that doesn't naturally skew Republican. We also have a show coming up on Wednesday about compost, including some angles to compost that will surprise you. Our Thursday show is going to be about comedy, and it's sort of apropos, or it seems kind of fitting that Roger Catlin and I were talking about this rather puny television comedy having won so many Golden Globes last night. but it does seem as though one of the places that comedy has gone perhaps more successfully right now is on stage. So we're going to be talking specifically about comedy on stage. Friday is The Nose. James Hanley will be leading a panel that will be talking about the movie Her, the Joaquin Phoenix movie in which a man falls in love with a computer consciousness voiced by Scarlett Johansson. Thanks to everybody who helped out today. We'll be back tomorrow.
Farmington. Yeah. On the radio.
I'm Kyone Wolf.
And I'm Kalina Wolf.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night, everybody.
God, how about that Jacqueline Bisset speech, right?
I know. It was like, did she smoke salvia or something?
Wait, are our mics still on? Jacqueline Bisset, she's so awesome.
Yeah, I liked her hair.